Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Jeff Taylor, professor of political science at Dort University in Sioux Center in Western Iowa. Jeff, welcome back to our program.
Glad to be with you again, Ben.
Kerry Covington joining us from the Iowa City studio, where he is associate professor with the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Kerry Covington, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Lots to get to later on in the hour. A real treat. Not that Jeff and Kerry aren't real treats as well. But later I'll be talking with Carla Marinucci. She's one of California's leading political writers. She writes for Politico often. She'll be delivering a home state view of the presidential candidate Tom Steyer in the second part of our program. Before that, we want to talk about Congress. Members of Congress returning after a 6-week recess next week. But let's get your views, first of all, on the politics of natural disasters. Of course, Dorian, a Category 5 storm when it made landfall in the Bahamas over the weekend, stalled out, decimating portions of the country's northern islands before moving slowly north to the southeast coast of our country. Now a Category 2 storm skirting the coast of Florida and Georgia. Now, history tells us, Kerry Covington, that public figures can be badly damaged by poor reactions to major natural disasters, right?
Yeah, that's true. Both at the national and the state and local level, the public, basically beginning in the 1950s, but especially ramping up during the Carter years when FEMA was created, has looked increasingly to the federal government for its response to disasters, and the president in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to this president, our current president, reacting to this hurricane during a news conference this week on Hurricane Dorian. Donald Trump said that before Dorian, he had never heard of a Category 5 hurricane.
Americans are strong, determined, and resilient, and we will support each other. And we will work very hard to minimize whatever the effect of what's coming at us. We don't even know what's coming at us. All we know is it's possibly the biggest. I'm not sure that I've ever even heard of a Category 5. I knew it existed, and I've seen some Category 4s. You don't even see them that much, but a Category 5 is something that I don't know that I've ever even heard the term, other than I know it's there. That's the ultimate, and that's what we have, unfortunately.
President Trump on a news conference a couple of days ago. Interesting, 4 such storms, including Hurricane Dorian, have threatened the U.S. since Donald Trump's presidency. And interesting in light of his remark. Jeff Taylor, what are your thoughts on how Donald Trump has reacted to Dorian so far?
Well, I think, really, presidents reacting to natural disasters, it's the kind of thing where really they're exercising kind of a leader of the nation, kind of in a non-political role, trying to bring relief, bring comfort to the people, not only who are in the path of the storm or who've been affected by it, but the whole country. And at the same time, it's as Kerry mentioned, it's a highly political role to play as well, because if it's mishandled, if you're seen as bumbling or uncaring or too aloof from the situation that impacts real people, then that can come back to bite you. So with Trump, I'm not surprised. There's a little bit of garbled syntax there, where he says he's not sure he's ever heard of a Category 5, but of course he kind of knew about it, but yet he'd never really heard about it. So it's all a bit confusing in terms of his explanation there.
Mm-hmm. Jeff says it's you have to be careful not to be too aloof about this, but or aloft, I might say. President George W. Bush, didn't his approval numbers tumble after he just did a flyover of Katrina, right?
Well, yeah. Bush was generally seen in 05 as being insufficiently caring about the conditions in Katrina. It was generally acknowledged that it was not handled well, and yet he gave a heck of a job to Brownie, his FEMA director.
Right, there's that quote.
And he only flew over. He didn't come in to see what was going on, feet on the ground. And, of course, New Orleans is a heavily African-American community. He's a Republican president, and that's had a context for people to politicize a situation that I'm sure he had no intention of having it be that way. But he knew that he had created that impression. He even remarked on it after the event that he had misstepped.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the return of members of Congress to Washington next week. They've had a six-week break. Let me start with you, Jeff Taylor. What do you see in store for us, in store for members of our lawmakers after this six-week break?
Well, if we think in terms of agenda for Congress coming up for this fall, it really depends on which part of Congress you're thinking about, because the Democrats, they control the House. Speaker Pelosi's agenda is going to be very different from Mitch McConnell's agenda over in the Senate, where the Republicans have a majority. And then in terms of President Trump, I don't think that most of us would consider him a real effective driver of the congressional agenda. For the most part, he's kind of relied on the Republicans in Congress to push legislation. And yet even there, there's a disconnect, because the Senate Republicans and Trump's agenda on illegal immigration and a number of other topics, including war and peace, foreign policy, they don't necessarily match up. So it's almost as though there's three different agendas going on in Washington, depending on where you're looking.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, what do you see? Also, what is history? I know you're a big observer of history. What does history tell us about what can get done between now and Election Day?
Well, first of all, I want to say Professor Taylor made a very astute observation that the House and Senate are very different. The House has a Democratic agenda. The Senate has a Republican agenda. In the most recent Gallup polls of what are the most important problems facing the country, mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans identify entirely different issues across the top five. That's never been the case. So we really have two different worldviews looking out. And so Democrats are looking at guns and impeachment. Republicans are looking at renewing, well, the new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. I don't remember how the title of that goes. Some people refer to it as NAFTA 2. Guns are going nowhere. Gun regulation is going nowhere in the Senate. So it's really two different sets of situations. And historically, the last 2 years before a presidential election, especially with divided control of Congress, is a recipe for gridlock, for nothing to be done, grandstanding for the most part, scoring political points, forcing votes on opponents that will make them suffer at the election ballot more than trying to get bills passed. So I think we'll see that kind of activity over the next year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about one thing you mentioned there, Carrie, trade. I'm reading from the New York Times yesterday, a key index showing that the American manufacturing sector contracting last month for the first time since 2016. This comes, of course, during the escalating trade war with China. What are your thoughts on how the direction of this trade war and how it's on the direction of it and how it's playing out in politics? Carrie, you first.
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that there are two very different political coalitions. And it's hard to imagine how Republicans are going to respond very negatively to this. Other numbers show, for instance, that our trade deficit overall is up substantially with the world. It's up with China. It's up with the European Union. Trade deficits are getting worse, not better. We're not winning, as Donald Trump would say, on trade deficits. He's imposing damage on farmers. But I'm not sure what sort of impact that mm-hmm. will have on his constituents. They focus on the things he's done that they like. The white evangelicals are not going to be caring too much about trade as long as he promises another conservative pro-life judge if Ruth Bader Ginsburg were to resign. So I don't see too much of an impact there. And it's just confirming what Democrats believe. It's not going to change anything there.
Jeff, at what point does the trade war cost Donald Trump and his Republican supporters in Congress real support among voters? Do you see that happening?
I think it's a possibility, but I do agree with Professor Covington in that oftentimes perception is reality, and I think the base of the Republican Party polls show around 80% support for Trump at this point, and that includes kind of the heartland states, including Iowa. Even though the farmers here tend to be hurt by tariffs, I think in the long run they're hoping that this can be can actually change some of the dynamics that we have with China and some of our trading partners to bring about a more advantageous situation reduce the trade deficit in the long run, even though in the short run it may not be working. So I think part of it is that kind of optimism or belief that in the long run it will work out. Now, if it's a year from now and we're looking at the fall of 2020 and things are still as they are and progress hasn't been made on returning the manufacturing base to the United States in the same way that Trump had promised, I think that could come back to bite him in the farm states and the industrial states.
Kerry.
Yeah, I was going to mention that Jeff is really right in the heart of where it could hurt Trump, the corn-growing communities of northwest Iowa and other states in the Midwest, that if you imagined Barack Obama having this kind of a contraction of farm economy, they would be abandoning him droves. But his support is really baked in among these folks at this point, and it would take another year of protracted difficulty for them to start to say, well, maybe we should look elsewhere. In that regard, it's ironic that as much as Trump has pitted himself against the Chinese may hold the keys to the election by whether they make a trade agreement that brings farm prices and farm commodities back or whether they stay out and let the farm economy crater and with it support for Trump.
It occurs to me, and I'll remind our listeners, Kerry Covington with us of the University of Iowa, Jeff Taylor of Dort University in Sioux Center, that on this program, Jeff and you and Kerry represent sort of the poles of Iowa's politics. Kerry in southeast Iowa in a county, Johnson County, which is majority Democratic in terms of voter registration. You, Jeff Taylor, I'm sure your county is majority Republican, one of the most solid Republican bases in our state. I wonder, Jeff Taylor, do you have any anecdotes or can you give us any more sense of what's going on there in the northwest part of the state?
Support for Trump is very solid here. There's always the exceptions. We do have Democrats in Sioux County and northwest corner here of the state, but they're definitely in the minority. And yes, I don't see much movement away from the president, regardless of the policies or the tweets or you know the controversy of the day. People seem to be sticking with him. I think a lot of the local politics really around here involves the contest for Steve King's seat, and is he going to retain that in the primary? We've got a local state senator, Randy Feenstra, who's probably his strongest challenger, and so I hear more talk about that than Trump at this point.
Briefly, tell us what kind of talk do you hear about Congressman King and his challengers?
Well, I think King is in some trouble. Partly the conservative base around here, many of them still agree with Congressman King's positions on issues, and they're even willing to say that when he talks to the media, his statements might be misinterpreted and twisted. And so there's a lot of sympathy for King among the conservative Republicans here. But the worry is that he can't win in the general election. a year from now, that J.D. Scholten, the likely Democratic nominee, almost beat him in the last election and might well beat him in this coming election. And so the fear is, do we stick with somebody that we generally like, or is he so gaffe-prone that we go with a conservative alternative?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the simmering debate among House Democrats over impeachment. Now, over this past recess, the six-week recess, the lawmakers went back to their home states and faced some frequently contentious town halls, activists pressuring the Democrats' holdouts to support impeachment proceedings. There were some new endorsements for action. Now, a majority of the U.S. House's 235 Democrats back in an impeachment inquiry. Carrie, where do you see Democrats standing on this question and going forward? Because I think I saw in one headline, the impeachment window is closing, isn't it? What does that mean?
Well, basically, one issue has a life cycle. It becomes really important, and then it begins to fade as other issues come along. And in the absence of more egregious actions or statements by Trump, the impeachment fire is going to dim as other issues pile on. And certainly during the Trump administration, we've seen an incredible speeding up of the cycle by which one controversy supplants the next. And it's hard to even remember what we were worrying about and what we thought was controversial 6 weeks ago. Who has any
or
idea?
Or even 2 or 3 weeks ago sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in that context, I do think impeachment is going to get swallowed up. It will only be fed if Trump feeds it. I think the fact that a candidate for the Democratic nomination who is leading by a substantial margin, Joe Biden, has said he hopes the Democrats don't impeach, sends a strong signal that there's a strong element of the Democratic Party that doesn't want to impeach him.
Mm-hmm. Also, Nancy Pelosi continues to tell colleagues the public isn't there on impeachment. Meanwhile, the Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler, the Democrat, says the House has already launched, in his words, formal impeachment proceedings. Jeff Taylor, your thoughts.
Well, I tend to agree that there's kind of a divide among the Democrats here, where I don't think Pelosi thinks it's politically wise this close to an election that the average voter out there is going to feel like this is overreaching, that let the Democratic process play out. Trump will be facing the voters in a little more than a year anyway. And so even though I think the activist base of the party would like to see him impeached, I would be surprised if it moves forward. I think some of what's being said, like Nadler's pronouncement, probably trying to appeal to the base of the party, although that can come back to bite them as well if you raise hopes, raise expectations, and then you don't follow through. But I would be very surprised if actual formal impeachment hearings begin, regardless of what Nadler's calling them.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to break, let's get a comment on the Brexit showdown across the Atlantic. Prime Minister Boris Johnson was swept into office in July. He vowed to take Britain out of the European Union, however that may happen, without a deal if need be. But Parliament this week has pulled the rug out from under him, can vote on legislation perhaps as already. I haven't checked the news lately that would block a withdrawal without a formal agreement with Brussels. Carrie, you know, how does this affect us? How does this affect our domestic politics? Is there a tie-in? People have compared Boris Johnson with Donald Trump in his type of brash politics.
Right. Yeah. Boris Johnson is emulating Trump's style, no doubt about it. But I think he runs the risk of becoming the Scaramucci of British politics, where he's in office and then he's gone before you know it. This was the fastest, shortest period of time that a prime minister has been in Britain without, and then having to call an election that anybody can remember. So he has a very tenuous hold right now. Who knows what's going to happen? As far as how it affects us, Britain's one of the countries we have a trade surplus with, one of the very few. But I think if Britain withdraws, it'll cause a lot of havoc in Britain and consequently may have some ripple effects on us as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more a sign that there's a limit to the willingness to follow a brash, controversial leader.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Taylor, do you see the ripples coming to this side of the Atlantic politically?
You know, I think Trump has been touting lately some sort of a bilateral agreement, trade agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. As kind of an alternative to their association with the EU. And, you know, so that but you know, Trump says and tweets a lot of things. So who knows how well defined that is whether that's something that it would actually materialize, you know, in the next year or two or not. But I think part of the problem with Johnson is that he's kind of an outlier because of the Conservative Party leadership. He was a Brexit supporter. Most of the leaders of his party opposed the vote on that referendum, and so even as foreign minister, he resigned from the cabinet of Theresa May because he didn't feel like she was pushing forward on that. So his position is known, but among the party leaders, he's really an exception to the rule, and so his position is tenuous there.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we take a break, I wanted to have us reflect a little bit on where we were 4 years ago in the Republican primary. This is a fun sort of exercise to do. Jeb Bush was already in a nosedive at this time. Scott Walker had risen and fallen, if we remember. Donald Trump was polling out in front, I think soon to fight off a surge from Ben Carson before pulling out in front of the whole field. The 2020 Democratic primary, by contrast, is what, Kerry, relatively stable, isn't it? Or how would you characterize it up to this point?
Well, it's become relatively stable. The dust has settled pretty recently, and we now have a clear top tier that we weren't able to identify before of Warren and Sanders and Biden. Warren and Sanders are splitting the same base. Biden's got the middle pretty much to himself, and the other candidates are on the periphery or nowhere to be seen at all over the horizon. So, we have seen a pretty clear settling out.
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize it up to this point, Jeff Taylor, any differently?
No, I agree with that assessment. But the one thing I would add is that I think Biden, although he is a pretty consistent front runner in the early states, including Iowa and nationally as well, I think his support is soft. I think a lot of that is name recognition. A lot of it is feelings of goodwill because he was Obama's vice president. But I think those votes could be wooed away, or they could be kind of stumbled away. There's questions about Biden in terms of the gaffes that he's making on the campaign trail. Is he just garbling facts, or is there some kind of diminished cognitive ability for him?
Okay, we have to go away. We'll be back with Jeff Taylor of Dort University in Sioux Center, Kerry Covington of the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Also, when we come back, we'll continue our Home State View series, a short conversation with Carla Marinucci. She's a senior writer for Politico's California Playbook, one of California's leading political writers. Will give us a home state view of Democratic Party presidential candidate Tom Steyer. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with that in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today with Kerry Covington, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Jeff Taylor, Professor of Political Science at Dort University in Sioux Center. We're going to ask Jeff and Kerry to sit on the sidelines for a moment while we continue our 2020 caucus series, Home State View. This is where we learn about the 2020 candidates by talking with a news media figure who has covered that candidate for some time in their home state. Today, a home state view of American billionaire, hedge fund manager, philanthropist, environmentalist, liberal activist, fundraiser,
fundraiser and 2020 Democratic Presidential Party candidate Tom Steyer. Joining us to do that, Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. She's been consistently named one of California's leading political writers and top political bloggers. Carla, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ben. Good to be with you.
Great to have you, because you are have been named consistently one of California's leading political writers, top political bloggers. What an honor to have you on. You've covered Tom Steyer for years, I understand.
That's right. I mean, first of all, it's an honor to be here. But yes, Tom Steyer, his whole presidential campaign is very interesting to us in California, because he's been describing himself as an outsider in the presidential race. But we in California know that he's been involved in politics here for almost a decade. Been a figure, an activist, and a very big donor.
All right.
To a lot of California measures, so no outsider here in California.
Right. So Tom Steyer's a new name to us here in Iowa, most of us here in Iowa, and to the rest of the nation. Tell us a little bit. Give us a sort of a nutshell view of his rise to prominence and wealth, and then his transformation to an activist in politics.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Steyer has been involved in finance, boy, since the 1980s, when he founded a Farallon Capital. That's an investment firm, and where he's made a ton of money. He has also had some investments with that firm that have come back to haunt him since, in terms of coal, in terms of private prisons. But boy, since making that money, he and his wife, Kat Taylor, have been huge philanthropists in all kinds of areas. They've given $40 million to Stanford University alone. That's his alma mater. But he's really been involved. One of his passions from the beginning has been the issue of climate change and environmental issues. That's when he's gotten involved in ballot measures going back to 2010 in California, when he combined with former Secretary of State George Shultz in trying to beat back efforts by oil industries to what he said was weaken California's environmental laws. And since then, he's been somebody who's been out there in California politics, putting his money in a whole variety of ballot measures, many of them involved in climate change. But he's also been interested in things like campaign finance reform, taxation issues, educational issues. And I have to say, Ben, in the beginning, when we first saw Tom Steyer come on the scene, he was a very wonky businessman. His speeches were very stilted. He was not a guy you would think would be ever interested in running for president. But he's been bitten by the bug, I think, in his many years in activism and California ballot measures. There were strong rumors that he was going to run for governor at one point. Also, very strong rumors that he might challenge Dianne Feinstein in her last run in 2018. He decided not to do that, and I think that's maybe one of the reasons why now he's decided he has to make some kind of stand in politics. This has been a long developing interest in his, and I think we have seen with his need to impeach campaign in the last couple of years, that's where it seems like he has really honed this interest in politics, in national politics, in a big way.
Right. Talk about that, because all of the Democratic candidates are, of course, very critical of President Trump, but Steyer has a unique take on it.
Yeah, his Need to Impeach campaign has taken him around the country. He has done more than 50 town halls, and he has amassed a mailing list of more than 8 million people who have signed those petitions. And the Steyer effort has used those names to kind of track voters to reach out to them, and he did it very effectively in the 2018 midterms. In terms of trying to approach voters, trying to reach out to them, and trying to push that Democratic blue wave. And a lot of people say he was very successful. Tom Steyer has donated to and has supported huge efforts at voter registration, particularly with regard to millennial voters. So a lot of people give him credit for helping to push the blue wave and helping Democrats take back the House. In California alone, he was involved in races, seven races in which Democrats flipped from Democratic to Republican. Those were critical races. So, mm-hmm. Tom's efforts have taken him around the country. But on the issue of impeachment, his Need to Impeach campaign has really put him out there in a very big way in front of a lot of Democrats in many states all over the country, and that's where I think he has sort of honed what has become his stump speech in the presidential race. He has turned from a wonky business speaker into a sort of fiery or more fiery presidential candidate because of that Need to Impeach campaign. I think that was the big difference.
Mm-hmm. Carla, talk a little bit about, we're in this series, we're asking about the candidates' teams, the people they like to surround themselves with. You mentioned Kat Taylor, his wife. Tell us a little bit more about the people he works with.
You know, what's interesting about Steyer's rise as a presidential candidate is that we haven't seen one sort of political guru behind this whole effort. A David Axelrod or a Jim Messina, such as took that role in the Obama campaign. In the beginning, when Steyer's activism sort of surfaced here in California, he relied heavily on Chris Lahane, who was a former White House spokesman. He ran Gore's chief press guy in the 2000 presidential race, and he's a well-known, respected Democratic strategist who has since gone on to become Airbnb's global head of communications. But Lahane was advising him in the beginning. Now we're not exactly seeing one big Democratic guru behind him. He has taken on people who have been very veteran in California, like Gil Duran, who worked for Jerry Brown, who worked for Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein. But Gil, like many other people, have moved on. Right now, it seems that Tom Steyer's biggest advisor is Tom Steyer, or maybe his brother, Jim Steyer. But the fact is that there are no sort of celebrity Democratic strategists, at least that we can see, that are behind the scenes with Tom.
Mm-hmm. Carla, what can you say about how Tom Steyer handles criticism?
You know, this is one of the areas where I think Steyer has some challenges in the sense of, look, he's a very rich guy who has grown up with a silver spoon in his mouth, had some of the best education possible when he grew up in New York. Does he have contact with average folks, and does he have people behind him who can say, who can tell him straight up the criticisms of his campaign? That's the question, because I think a lot of Democrats watching this campaign would have advised Tom Steyer not to go for a presidential run, instead to put that $100 million he's talking about into state legislative races, into key races like trying to defeat Mitch McConnell. Clearly, there are a lot of Democrats who would have given him that kind of very stark criticism, and maybe he's not listening to them, I think some Democrats would be saying. But, you know, Tom Steyer is a guy who has been super successful in business and super successful in education and in philanthropy areas. He is opinionated. He has strong opinions. And whether people can give him the straight-up criticism of his campaign right now, that's the big question, I think.
Okay. Carla, to end this fascinating conversation with you, we like to look from our home state view candidate guests for something interesting or quirky, a footnote about Tom Steyer in this case, a little-known aspect of him to end the conversation. Can you come up with one of those?
Yeah, I think if you're looking at what may be driving Tom Steyer to try to make a difference, I think not a lot of people know that his father, a Jewish Navy veteran in World War II, became one of the prosecutors in the Nuremberg trials. And Steyer has mentioned this not too often, but the fact is that was a role that his father played that made a difference in the world. And I think that may be one of the things when Tom Steyer is looking at this race that he hopes to emulate.
Right. The Nuremberg trials that following the Second World War that put many of the Nazi criminals on trial, convicted
yes.
them, and in some cases put to death. Carla Marinucci, thank you so much. Senior writer for Politico's California Playbook, joining us from the Bay Area with her insights. Carla, fascinating. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
About 10 minutes left of our Politics Wednesday. Let's pivot back to Carrie Covington and Jeff Taylor. Jeff Taylor of Dort University in Sioux Center. Carrie Covington of the University of Iowa in Iowa City. We want to talk about the 2020 race, but first of all, Carrie Covington, any comments on Tom Steyer as we listen to that conversation with Carla Marinucci?
Well, the interesting thing about what she was saying was what a multidimensional person he is, how he has positions on issues and has been involved in politics in the past. And I think he made a mistake, if he was really always running for president, to hitch his wagon strictly on the need to impeach Donald Trump. I mean, all of the ads he ran had little to say about him and more to say about the need to impeach Trump. And then when he shifts gears to be president, he's already created that image, that reputation. Now he has to overcome that and say, look, I'm something more than just against Trump. My family background has led me to do this on education or this on the environment or that on climate change. And it's going to be hard to get that message pushed through the idea, well, he's just this one-note candidate who's against Trump.
Do you see his campaign doing that, though, in Iowa?
Well, yeah, he's running ads in Iowa now that are trying to flesh out his personality. It's the classic thing you do. You talk about your family background, your personal background, and I suspect in the next week we'll start seeing him roll out policy position ads as well. But he's created an obstacle for himself by putting so much time and money into being against Trump and putting himself personally in that story.
Let's broaden this conversation out as we end this Politics Wednesday edition to the 2020 race as a whole. I'm reading from Politico. Here's the quote. The bottom is falling out of the Democratic presidential primary, and the top tier, no longer five candidates, but three, is becoming more insurmountable. Jeff Taylor, what do you think of that shorthand analysis? Is that what's happening?
Well, that seems a bit premature to me. We're still quite a few months away from the Iowa caucuses and the first voting. I think based upon the DNC's rules for inclusion in the debates, and they keep getting steeper as we go along. So the bottom third, they have dropped out of the debates. But on the other hand, In a state like Iowa, even if you're not in the October debates, I don't know that that necessarily means that you couldn't get some traction. I mean, and a lot of things can happen between now mm-hmm. and late January, early February. So to me, I think the race is still fluid mm-hmm. at this point.
Five presidential candidates, to my count, have dropped out since the start of the summer. 20 are still in the race, only half of them qualifying for this next televised debate. Only three contenders polling above the single digits, Carrie Covington, Biden, Warren, and Sanders. How likely do you think this is to change? Of course,
well,
we could have.
Jeff makes a good point. The debates are aimed at a national audience. The nominating process is state by state. So if I'm someone who's not one of the top 10 and can't make a national appeal, I just go the traditional route of the last 30 years, which is go to Iowa, go to New Hampshire, go to South Carolina, talk to people, give speeches, run ads, and pull off the surprise. I mean, what you want to do is not build up media expectations, but you want to exceed media expectations when the caucuses and primaries come. So if in the national polls I'm running at 2-3%, and then in Iowa I go 15-16%, boom, I'm somebody. Biden only gets 28-30. Wow, he's dropped his support. And, mm-hmm. and as Jeff said, it's fluid. So the candidates aren't able to go the national route, but that may be good for them because traditionally you go state by state, feet on the ground, money in the state, way to win the nomination.
Jeff, let me ask you, how do you see this set of Democratic National Committee rules winnowing the field in terms of the polling formula and the fundraising formula? How do you see that shaping this field of candidates differently than in the past?
Well, we've seen it already, because I think, you know, the half dozens that have dropped out, I think it's largely because they haven't been able to be included in maybe the first or the second round, but certainly not the third round of debate. So partly we're seeing attrition as a result of those rules of them acting as gatekeepers. And I sympathize with the Democrats who complain about it, that it's arbitrary, that in many of the early states like Iowa and New Hampshire, we haven't had approved DNC-approved polls even taken since the second debate. And so some of those candidates who got a bounce out of that nationally, or even, you know, in terms of Iowa or New Hampshire, unless it happens to be a particular poll that the DNC approves of, they're not even factoring that in. So I think there's some unfairness to the process, but we're seeing that play out. But at the same time, I agree with Kerry that I think to some extent the effect of the debates may be exaggerated long term for the candidates who have the money and the time to stay in and do retail politicking in these early states. They could still get some traction.
Kerry, what do you see in this battle between the progressive and the moderate wings of the Democratic Party, the battle between the camp that says massive restructuring is needed to our political and even our corporate system versus the camp that seeks to, for lack of a better way of saying, restore America to the way it was before Trump?
Right, right. I see the Democrats going down a path the Republicans went down a decade ago when you saw the Tea Party movement, and you can even trace that back further. But the Republican Party basically split along those similar kinds of lines. And one of the things that fed Trump was that the mainstream establishment candidates have for the last 20 years, 30 years, appealed to that strong right-wing base, but then not delivered anything when they've been elected. And so that had opened it up to Trump. Will that do it for Democrats? I don't know. But I just see the Democrats going down a very similar road as the Republicans went down a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. Have to address this. We heard late last week the DNC is set to reject Iowa's virtual caucuses because of cybersecurity threats. Now, let's think back. It was about half a year ago that the Iowa Democratic Party presented this plan to the Democratic National Committee to hold these so-called virtual caucuses over the phone system alongside the regular caucuses February 3rd. Now the DNC recommending rejecting the plan. The DNC has concerns about this telecaucusing and how it could be susceptible to hackers. Jeff, how big of a setback is this for the Iowa caucuses?
I don't know that it is a setback, really. It's from what I've read, the Iowa Democratic Party was resistant to the idea. They were kind of reluctantly going along with this as a compromise because the DNC would really prefer Iowa and other caucus states to move to a primary. And so I'm not sure that that the state party is that disappointed that they're not going to be able to do this kind of halfway measure, sort of a little bit of a concession to a wider wholesale participation. And personally, I like the process that we have. I think even more than the Republicans, the Democrats, you're actually meeting with your neighbors and you're physically, publicly identifying with what candidate you're for based upon, you know, which corner of the room you stand in. So yeah. I think you lose something when you go to a telecaucus that actually is valuable.
Okay, well, we have about a minute left. Kerry Covington, your thoughts on the ruling, the DNC's view of the Iowa's planned virtual caucuses.
Yeah, the National Party is responding to a national trend, which is that the voters want to be the ones who decide. They don't want the parties having any role in the process. And any kind of a caucus, think what a caucus means. I mean, the word caucus means to get together and talk. And people don't want that. They want something precise. They want something exact. They want something transparent. They want something official and final. Caucuses are run by parties. They're informal.
They have notoriously low turnout, 15-16%.
Right. And the last two, we've had races that were incredibly close, Santorum and Mitt Romney and then Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, caucuses can't deliver in a tight race a clear, decisive winner, and that's what the people want now.
Mm-hmm. But still, if we move to a primary, which seems to be what the DNC is pushing Iowa to, then we run up against the New Hampshire problem. Yeah. They said we can't be a primary.
New Hampshire's constitution requires them to be the first primary state, so Iowa would have to take a back seat. Mm-hmm. Or there would be some kind of a contest where we start having primaries today.
Okay, so with that sort of being painted into a corner, how do you do you just keep the caucuses the way they are, Kerry?
I don't know. My I felt 4 years ago that the caucuses were soon to be extinct species. There's
really
only six states left with caucuses.
Jeff Taylor, as we finish up today, do you see soon to be extinct species for the Iowa caucuses as well?
Well, it's been, I don't know, it's been going strong since at least 1972, 1976. I'm sure the state of Iowa, both parties would do everything they can to prevent that from happening. But you're right, it's becoming more and more scarce compared to certainly even 20, 30 years ago.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes on it. Jeff Taylor, professor of political science at Dort University in Sioux Center. Kerry Covington, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Kerry and Jeff, thanks for joining us this hour.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Shirley Wong, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Also helped today from Stephanie Nobrega. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.